Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. Coming to you live from our studios in central London, I'm Julian Marshall. It was only 2 days ago that the Kenyan president, William Ruto, offered to have a conversation with protesters who last week had taken to the streets of the capital, Nairobi, and elsewhere to demonstrate against proposed tax increases. But that conversation never happened. The mainly Gen Z protesters are clearly in no mood to compromise. And on the day the politicians voted on the new finance bill, they broke into Parliament, sending MPs fleeing down a tunnel and set part of the building on fire. Out on the streets, the police responded with force, using live fire and tear gas. At least five people are reported to have been shot dead and many more injured. A medic who had been tending to the wounded said he'd received some serious injuries.
I've actually received close to 30 to 40 patients. Those who are seriously injured have been around 9 to 10. Seriously injured with broken legs. Some who have been shot on their thighs. Some who have been shot on the head slightly. The bullet passing through.
And the government is clearly sensitive about the dissemination of images from the streets of Nairobi. The private news network, KTN, today made this announcement.
We would like to inform our viewers that we have received threats from authorities of intention to shut us down. We would like to inform the public of our commitment to defend the public interest, and we shall not be cowed by any threats.
Within the past couple of hours, President Ruto has addressed the nation, promising to take action to restore order.
Today, Kenya experienced an unprecedented attack on its democracy, rule of law, and the integrity of its constitutional institutions. An otherwise legitimate expression of the fundamental rights and freedoms of assembly, demonstration, picketing, and petitioning of public authorities by a section of law-abiding citizens of the Republic of Kenya was infiltrated and hijacked by a group of organized criminals. I hereby put on notice the planners, financiers, orchestrators, and abettors of violence and anarchy.
And just prior to that address, the government announced that the army was to be deployed to back up the police. The BBC's Anita Nkonge spoke to me earlier from Nairobi.
The Cabinet Secretary for Defence, Aden Duale, has put out a gazette deploying the Kenya Defence Forces out to support the National Police Service in response to what they say is a security emergency caused by the ongoing violent protests in various parts of Kenya, and which has seen destruction and breaching of critical infrastructure. Today was the third sitting of the precarious, rather controversial financial bill, which is what many people have come out to protest against. As that was happening across the country, there have been people mobilizing each other, protesting and saying that they reject the finance bill and calling on their members of parliament to vote no to the finance bill. So, for example, here in the capital city, we saw flocks of people coming from all sides of Nairobi into the central business district, all saying that they're peaceful, all saying that they just want their voices heard, and all saying that they want the finance bill to be rejected. What then transpired was we saw that the police retreated, sometimes throwing tear gas, but retreated towards the Parliament House, but eventually they were overwhelmed. We have got unconfirmed reports that some people were shot dead, but that's yet to be confirmed. We do know that scores were injured, but as this scuffle was happening, many managed to breach the Parliament and even enter it. We've seen on TikTok people posting videos of themselves in the Senate, in the offices. It has been a very chaotic day, very surprising. No one could have guessed this would have happened. We've also seen City Hall, where the governor of Nairobi has his office burnt. The fire was put out by the police tanks.
And there are reports that parts of the parliamentary complex were also set alight, Anita.
Yes, that is correct. It's really not quite clear who set it on fire. It's hard to say whether it's protesters or people who are hired. It's been a very confusing day, and perhaps the truth will come out with time.
And these kinds of violent protests in Nairobi and indeed elsewhere in the country are relatively unusual.
Well, first of all, this kind of protest in general is very, very unusual. First of all, it being spearheaded by Generation Z, you know, that those are who are born from 1997 and above, them coming out and saying that they're tired of heavy taxes, tired of high cost of living, wanting to call their government to account. And the fact that there's no face or leader to this protest, that in itself has never been seen before.
That was the BBC's Anita Nkonge speaking to me earlier from Nairobi. Well, among the protesters today was a British Kenyan activist, Aun Obama. She's the half-sister of former US President Barack Obama and runs a foundation for disadvantaged youth and children called Sauti Ku.
The young people were being tear gassed. They were shooting them with rubber bullets and later on with live bullets. So nobody was expecting to be shot at. And we came out there in order to protest peacefully and to raise awareness for the plight of young people. And suddenly, we had all these trucks and armed policemen throwing tear gas and throwing, live ammunition. The young people were peaceful. And in a way, I feel sorry for the police because they were just doing what they were told, I guess. They were following orders, but really, there must be a human factor to following orders and knowing what the right thing is to do. So it's a shame that it all escalated and resulted in innocent lives being lost, innocent lives of our children. All they wanted to do was to walk to Parliament, present their case and be heard. As simple as that. And this is their constitutional right. That is all. And it's so unfortunate that we did not listen to this. And instead, we shot at them.
How are you feeling tonight yourself? I mean, you were tear gassed.
I have my chest is a bit congested, my eyes hurt, I have a headache, but that's nothing compared to what the young people have experienced. I was a lot safer than many. Many of them were standing in front of those canisters of tear gas and were being sprayed with this pink liquid. I don't even know what it is. So what I experienced was nothing in comparison. So in other words, when you ask me how I feel, I can tell you I'm fine. I really am fine. I worry about the young people. I am fine.
How do you expect this to develop in the coming days? Because the protesters say they intend to continue this week. The government is about to deploy the army, I understand, to back up the police. So both sides look as if they have no intention of backing down.
But look how terrible that is. The young people say they still want to make their voices heard. They're coming out to have you listen to them. They're walking on foot, carrying our flag and banners, paper, and we're sending the army? We're sending the police? And why are we sending the army? Because we sent the police threw tear gas at them, the police shot at them, and still they walked. And still they walked. And now we're sending the army? So now where we just got our eyes burnt and our chest congested, what is going to happen to us if we walk again? Are you going to gun us down? Are you going to gun those children down? And the problem is that there are so many of them. And at the moment, I saw posters that said, we are no longer afraid. We are no longer afraid. And another one said, I have nothing to lose. It is very, very powerful. And I think sometimes we older need to have some humility. Young people can teach us a lot. And we need to accept this and maybe bow back. It is not wrong. It is not embarrassing. It does not make you weak if you stop and listen to these young people. It makes you stronger because it shows that you have humility. And there's greatness in humility. But there's a lot of weakness in using force to fight people who are coming to you with flags, your flag, and banners explaining to you what they want and what they don't want.
That was the British Kenyan activist Aun Obama. She's the half-sister of former US President Barack Obama. She was speaking from Nairobi. But why such a visceral reaction, as we saw in the Kenyan capital today, to something as mundane as a finance law? I asked the BBC's Africa editor, Will Ross.
I think it's just been a sort of tipping point of, you know, combination of the cost of living, life getting increasingly difficult, many young Kenyans getting an education, then struggling to get a job, prices of everything going up. Then President William Ruto comes in a couple of years ago and he says, I'm for the hustlers, the workers. I'm going to build this country for you so that you can rise up. And then all they have complained about since he's been in power is tax after tax after tax. And there have been several already before this bill came in. Add to that the perception amongst many Kenyans that the political elite is horribly corrupt, and therefore they don't feel that these taxes are going to be spent wisely. They also look at the country's debt, about $80 billion, and they say, where did the debt come from? It came from the politicians, the administration before William Ruto, but he was the vice president at the time. And Mr. Ruto is saying, we need these taxes to bring down that debt. But people are saying, well, you brought the debt on us, and now you're going to load it on our heads. And people are just saying, we've had enough.
So this is a protest as much against a system as the immediate finance bill.
I think it is, because drop the bill was the kind of slogan, getting rid of this bill. But even if by some miracle, and it didn't happen, but if by some miracle the president had adopted a conciliatory tone and had said, OK, we're going to pause this entire process for the next 6 months, there will be no more tax increases, I do not believe it would have killed off this movement, because it's this young, the Gen Z generation who are, they're just saying, we've had enough.
President Ruto seemed to conflate criminals and protesters. Is that a way of justifying a robust response?
I think so, yes. He talked about a legitimate protest movement being hijacked by criminals, and he then went on to say that it was a critical turning point in how we respond to grave threats to our national security. I expect there will be a pretty harsh crackdown, and even ahead of today's events, at least a dozen people were abducted, according to rights groups, people who were mobilising and trying to organise the protests.
And very briefly, the first contingent of an international police force for Haiti, Kenyans, has arrived in the capital, Port-au-Prince, desperately needed at home.
You could say that, an extraordinary coincidence that they've landed there today, but the entire deployment is fairly unpopular in Kenya, where people are saying, we need security sorted out at home, and what on earth are we doing across there in Haiti? President Ruto says we're doing our international duty, and of course there'll be some money from America for it.
That was the BBC's Africa editor, Will Ross. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Julian Marshall, and this is NewsHour. Coming up, a scientific breakthrough that may lead to robots looking more like humans.
They've figured out a way to bring together a robot body and human skin. What they've done is make these anchors between the skin and the robot that mimic human skin. And this is quite exciting because their approach might make the skin more durable and long-lasting over time.
More on that later in this edition of NewsHour. Our headlines, though, this hour. Kenya's president has accused criminals of hijacking huge protests against tax rises, during which parliament buildings were set on fire and five people were shot dead by police. And the 14-year legal battle of Julian Assange is drawing to a close, with the WikiLeaks founder heading to a remote US island for a brief court hearing. We'll be hearing from that very island in about 15 minutes. This is Julian Marshall with NewsHour live from the BBC in London. In Germany, a group of podcasters has used an artificial intelligence tool in an attempt to track down a suspected terrorist who'd been on the run for 30 years. Now, as Tim Mansell reports, the police want access to the same facial recognition software used by the journalists.
A converted industrial building in Berlin, home to a podcast studio called Undone.
We are Legion.
In 2023, Undone released a series called Legion Most Wanted.
It's Legion, Most Wanted. A listener had told them he'd met a woman who claimed to be a suspected terrorist, Daniela Kletter. Kletter had been on the run for 30 years. The Undone team decided to check their listener's story out. So, with the help of an expert, they used an AI tool to compare a picture of the woman with a picture of Daniela Kletter.
And the first software said, no, that's not the same person.
There's no match.
No match.
This is Patrick Stegemann, co-founder of Undone. He and the team then got the AI expert to try something else, a tool that searches the internet for possible matches.
And bang, it works like this woman, she's in Berlin.
Patrick and a colleague went to look for her, but Daniela Kletter was nowhere to be found. Imagine their astonishment when, 2 months later...
Police in Germany have arrested a former member of the far-left Red Army faction who had been on the run for 30 years, 65-year-old Daniela Kletter, who's suspected of...
The Red Army faction, also known as the Baader-Meinhof gang, was founded in 1970. In the late 80s and early 90s, it claimed responsibility for a number of prominent assassinations.
The head of West Germany's biggest bank has been murdered in a car bomb attack. A left-wing terrorist group, the Red Army faction, is thought to be responsible. Alfred Herrhausen was head of the Deutsche Bank and an advisor to Chancellor Kohl.
Wir hatten einen vertraulichen Hinweis bekommen hier.
The police chief, Friedo de Vries, says the arrest of Daniela Kletter came after they were tipped off by a member of the public, not by the podcast. In fact, the police aren't allowed to use the software used by the podcast makers. But Friedo de Vries says that needs to change.
Das, was uns weiterbringen würde, und das ist,
what would help us and what we need in 2024 is to be able to compare photos that we've got with photos on the internet. I think we need to have that discussion that we should be allowed to search for people online beyond our own police databases using artificial intelligence.
The main opposition party in Germany, the CDU, agrees. In a document submitted to Parliament, it says the Kletter case highlights an urgent need to change the law.
It's the end of May and there's a big conference going on for the next 3 days here in Berlin. It's called Republika. And as one person's told me, it's a gathering of everybody who's important in the digital community in Germany.
Are you Teresa?
I'm Teresa, yes.
Hello. How are you?
Teresa Widlock is the chairman of LODE. That's the Association for Liberal Internet Policy in Germany. She's unimpressed by the argument that the law needs to change.
The dangers are to everyone's civil liberties. And what we as LODE always say is not everything that could be done should be done by the police.
If the police had access to the software we're talking about, perhaps they would have found Daniela Kletter significantly sooner than they did.
Yeah, maybe. But police shouldn't be striving for being faster than criminals, but for being more decent than criminals.
And even Patrick Stegemann, whose podcast used AI to search for a terrorist suspect, is nervous about the wider use of facial recognition software.
At the end, we decided, yeah, it's justified in this case because Daniela Kletter, she's part of a terrorist organization, but nonetheless, I'm pretty happy that the police can't use this kind of software because I don't want the state having these possibilities and this power.
Patrick Stegemann ending that report by Tim Mansell, and you can hear more on this story in this week's assignment, Germany's AI Detectives, on the BBC World Service and on BBC Sounds. Israel's Supreme Court has ruled unanimously that ultra-Orthodox or Haredi religious students can no longer be exempt from military service. With Israel's ultra-Orthodox population growing fast and the Gaza War leading to a shortage of military recruits, the issue has become increasingly divisive. Far-right religious parties in Benjamin Netanyahu's coalition government have strongly opposed a change in the law. The Movement for Quality Government in Israel, which brought the case, claimed the ruling meant the government must immediately begin drafting all 63,000 ultra-Orthodox yeshiva students eligible for military service. Boaz Bithmut is a member of the Knesset for Israel's ruling Likud party. What was his reaction to the judgment?
Honestly, a bit surprised because, I mean, we are now at Parliament working on a bill which for the first time will make sure that Haredim, meaning ultra-Orthodox, will go to the army. And the fact that the Supreme High Court involves again in the middle of the work is surprising. I think there was no need for this intervention because it's going to be done anyway.
You say it's going to be done anyway. How close are you?
It's evolving in a very positive way. 2 years ago, when that bill was proposed or passed in Parliament for school, ultra-Orthodox parties were against the bill. Today, they are for. So you see, the process is positive. Yet, and that is an important point, we are now at war. We don't need war between ourselves, between Jews. And this is why I say, and I said it also in the committee, this is something that we should do not as a revolution, but as an evolution.
Your Likud MK colleague, Eli Dalal, has appealed to the ultra-Orthodox community, saying that regardless of the court ruling, defending the land of Israel is a great mitzvah or religious duty in itself. And this is a historic opportunity to create a broad consensus around one of the most complex issues in Israeli society. Do you agree?
Look, I'll tell you honestly, I mean, what makes me really sad is that we make out of it today a political issue and should be a national issue, which is national interest. And I will explain. Look, those, I mean, who are now in favor, or you see the demonstrators talking about Haredi, you have to go to the army. What they really want is to create more tension inside our society, which, as you know, we're at war right now. Yet, there is no contradiction between being ultra-religious or Orthodox, if you want, and going to the army. And if you look at the Bible, at the Old Testament, and you see even Moses talking to his brothers and telling them, some of the tribes, aren't you going to join the war? Are you going to leave us by ourselves? So you see that there is no contradiction whatsoever. There was this acceptance, and now this is going to be a big change in our society. For me, it's exactly the same change where 20 years ago, you wouldn't think of women being in combat units, and today it's totally normal to see women in tanks or women in Gaza. Same with Haredi boys. It's a change, but as I said, we shouldn't do it as a revolution. We shouldn't go to war against the Haredim. These are our brothers. I said today to my friends, our soldiers have to pray, and Haredi boys have also to fight.
But you also face a lot of resistance, don't you, from ultra-Orthodox politicians and leaders to such a move?
Look, ultra-Orthodox are exactly like secular people. You've got different forms, different currents in the Orthodox world. And I meet big rabbis. Some tell me, you know, those who come and pray should not go to the army, but those who don't should go immediately. This is a big change. You must understand, in Judaism, for ultra-Orthodox, learning the Torah, this is like an order. This is what you do. This is the biggest mitzvah, if you want. So it's a big change. And as I said again, this is a bill that has to pass through consent. And Supreme High Court, with all due respect, we vote for members of parliament. We don't vote for judges. This brings us back again to the big, big debate we had last year in Israel concerning judicial reform.
MP Boaz Bismuth. You're with News Hour, and scientists in Japan have found a new way to attach modified human skin to complex humanoid robot surfaces. Chris Dorsey is an associate professor at the Institute for Experiential Robotics at Northeastern University in Boston. What exactly did they do?
So you might want to put skin on a robot face to make it look realistic. The skin is very soft and stretchable, but the underlying robot face is very hard material. It makes it really hard to get a three-dimensional shape. So what they've done is make these anchors between the skin and the robot that mimic human skin. So it is very similar to the skin ligaments that go between the skin of our face and the muscles underneath. And this is quite exciting because their approach might make the skin more durable and long-lasting over time.
Is it live skin?
It is live skin cells, yes, mixed in with collagen.
And how long does it stay alive?
So that's not something they addressed directly in the paper, but what they did demonstrate was culturing the collagen and the skin cells over a week.
Is keeping the skin alive the main challenge at the moment?
I think that's a rather large challenge. So one of the things that the scientists in this work have not done is investigate blood vessels and lymphatic vessels that would help transport nutrients and oxygen to the skin cells and also transport them away.
Are there any particular advantages to using modified human skin rather than synthetic skin for humanoid robots?
Yes, there are a couple of advantages. So one is that skin has self-healing properties. So if we have a robot that's out in the world and it scrapes or cuts itself, it could heal rather than needing to apply new material. Another is that skin has touch sensors and temperature sensors already embedded within it and may also be able to do things like help the robot sweat to cool off, which means that the robot itself could do more work.
Is this something of a competition to see whether synthetic or real skin will win out, or are there different uses for each?
It's a bit of a competition between different research groups, for sure. But also, I see synthetic skin without any biological components, as well as engineered skin with skin cells in it, as having different purposes. Maybe we would want to use a self-healing material for a robot that will go out and do something for a few days, but we might want a robot that looks really realistic or that will last for a really long time to have the self-regeneration and self-healing properties of human skin.
Is this a procedure that's only applicable to humanoid robots, or could it have any use for humans as well?
One of the things in the paper that I thought was really interesting is they proposed to use the skin that they had engineered to understand wrinkle formation in humans. It could also have lots of potential uses for things like prosthetic devices, which would interface with your own skin.
That was Professor Chris Dorsey. You're listening to NewsHour. I'm Julian Marshall, and you're with NewsHour, broadcasting to you live from the BBC in London. A plane carrying the WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange has just landed on the remote US Pacific territory of the Mariana Islands, where he'll go through legal procedures that should result in him being set free and flying on to Australia. He's been wanted by the United States for leaking a vast trove of classified documents back in 2010. Since then, he spent 7 years in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he'd sought political asylum, and more recently 5 years in London's Belmarsh prison, fighting extradition to the United States, where he faced 18 charges relating to the leaking of those documents. He flew out of London on Monday, and on the Mariana Islands, a judge is expected to sign off on a plea deal under which he'll plead guilty to a single charge under the US Espionage Act in return for a prison term, which he's already served in Belmarsh. The BBC's Shaima Khalil is in Saipan, capital of the Mariana Islands. What's likely to happen in the coming hours?
Julian Assange is due to proceed with his guilty plea in a U.S. district court here in Saipan. And the reason he's here is because he did not want to be in continental United States because of his deep mistrust of the U.S. government. He has refused to travel to mainland U.S. because he simply doesn't know what will happen to him if he did. And so according to the U.S. Department of Justice, the guilty plea will be finalized here in this U.S. territory of Saipan. And also logistically, it is much closer to Australia from mainland U.S. or Hawaii, for example. And so after this whole saga, this journey that you pointed out, Julian, the final chapter will happen here when, after a judge signs it off, Julian Assange will, for the first time after a very long time, walk out a free man to then head back to his home country of Australia.
I know the US government has been under pressure for a very long time to do something like this. President Biden's behind this, is he?
President Biden is behind this, but I think there's been a huge deal of diplomacy on Australia's side. There's been a plea by the Australian Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, who has on many occasions said this has lasted long enough and that it needed to end. He recently, in the few hours that we heard about the deal, said that whatever you think about Julian Assange, this should find an ending and that he should come home. The details of this are quite sketchy, and even his wife, when asked about it, said that she was limited in what she could say. But we do know that as it stands, the agreement is that he pleads guilty for a single felony of illegally obtaining and disclosing national security material, and that was in exchange for his release from a UK prison. And originally, the US wanted to prosecute him for 18 counts, mostly under the Espionage Act, for releasing confidential military records, diplomatic messages. Had he been convicted of that, he would have spent his life in prison. There is a big turn now because of that deal and this uncommon and very unique location to end a legal saga that has lasted for nearly a decade and a half and spanned five countries.
That was BBC's Shaima Khalil speaking from the remote US Pacific territory of the Mariana Islands. Well, since those classified US military documents were leaked in 2010, Mr. Assange has become a hero to free speech campaigners and a villain to those who believed he endangered US security and intelligence sources. James Ball is a supporter of Mr. Assange and worked with him back in 2010. Speaking to NewsHour earlier, he justified the release of so many cables without any redaction.
It's true that the reckless way in which Assange published some of these put people at risk. And yet the revelation shed light on the deaths of genuinely tens, if not hundreds of thousands of civilians. And I think the hypothetical blood of careless redaction shouldn't sort of drown out the real sort of bloodshed that was revealed in the publication of the documents.
James Ball and Stephen Silver is a retired officer with the US Diplomatic Security Service. He used to work at the US consul in Peshawar in Pakistan and was one of many whose diplomatic cables sent, he thought, in confidence back to colleagues in Washington and around the world, were subsequently leaked by Julian Assange, causing significant distress to local staff and volunteers named in the cables, including local police inspector Malik Navid.
From 2006 to 2007, I was the regional security officer, U.S. consulate Peshawar in northwest Pakistan, you know, in charge of all our security of our people, property and information.
And how did you get to know Inspector General Malik Navid?
Before I'd even gotten there, I'd heard about him and heard that he was, you know, helping us with security for our people and our building. So that's how I came to know him. He was the head of the Frontier Constabulary. His cousin, a man named Malik Saad, was the chief city police officer of Peshawar, basically the chief of police, who also was a friend of mine and also helped provide security for our consulate and for our people. And then in January of 2007, Malik Saad, Navid's cousin, was killed by a suicide bomber.
So describe to me the moment you saw Malik Navid's name in these leaked WikiLeaks cables.
His son had reached out to me and told me that that had happened. It wasn't just my cables. It was me and probably two, maybe even three others who had written about him in the past. So he had been like an institutional friend to the United States.
I mean, I think the point I'm trying to make is that arguably Malik Navid had already been outed as somebody who was very close to the United States before his name went into the public domain in these cables.
If he was outed in any sense, it was because the Taliban, the TTP, the Tariqi Taliban Pakistan, wanted to kill him because he was stepping up security measures to counter their influence and their attacks in the Northwest Frontier Province. So in that sense, yes, he was a known quantity. But I know that both him and his cousin had told me that they wanted to be careful about being seen with me or with any other State Department asset in the Northwest Frontier Province because, you know, the ISI would think that they were, you know, assets, you know.
The Pakistan Intelligence Services.
Exactly, yes.
Was just wondering, though, whether his naming in these cables then put his life at risk. Or had it always been at risk?
Well, when he got named and when the Pakistani government decided that they were, all of a sudden, out of nowhere, they came up with corruption charges against him, out of the blue. And by doing so, by charging him with corruption, they took away his police protection detail. And that exposed him to, you know, all kinds of threats from the TTP.
What then happened to him?
He was basically under house arrest. Eventually, he had to relocate to Islamabad because staying in Peshawar without a police protective detail was basically, he was on borrowed time.
And was Malik Navid able to live a normal life in Islamabad?
Actually, I spoke to him 15 minutes ago because I wanted to reach out to him prior to this interview. He's living okay now. He's no longer under house arrest.
How long was he under house arrest?
I would say close to 10 years. You know, this investigation, quote unquote investigation, was hanging over his head for a number of years.
But he was eventually acquitted of those corruption charges.
Yes, they dropped the charges. I guess that's what happened. So as he said it to me just now, the Pakistani generals aren't out to get me anymore.
So today you would say he's okay?
He's okay, yeah. But a number of years of his life, he was under the cloud of suspicion. He was considered a traitor to Pakistan. His family felt exposed. His son traveled to the United States. I was able to work to get him asylum here in the United States.
I mean, you're doubtless familiar with the arguments, but those who support Julian Assange say that the release of those cables shed light on the deaths of genuinely tens, if not hundreds, of thousands of civilians. There is a counterbalance to what happened to your friend.
Tens of thousands? Like who? What are we talking about? What tens of thousands of civilians has the U.S. government killed? I mean, that's tenuous at best. What these cables did was endanger American diplomats, American soldiers, American NGOs. There's no journalistic intent here. I honestly believe he has malign intent. He's not doing this to better the world. He's attacking the United States.
That was Stephen Silver, retired officer with the U.S. Diplomatic Security Service. And Stella Assange is Julian Assange's wife. She was a member of his legal team, hired back in 2011 to fight on his behalf against Mr. Assange's extradition to Sweden on sexual assault charges which were eventually dropped. The couple have two young children and were married in Belmarsh Prison in London in 2022. Stella spoke to NewsHour's Tim Franks earlier today from Sydney as her husband was en route to the North Mariana Islands.
Of course, I'm concerned that something could go wrong. It's been a long build up till this moment. And obviously the agreement is not finalized until all the proper processes have occurred. And so it does have to go before a judge.
Am I right in saying that Julian Assange will plead guilty to stealing classified information and will accept that he is going to be served a prison sentence, but that sentence obviously will be taken into account by the time he's already served in jail on remand in Britain?
The plea agreement concerns a single charge under the Espionage Act for obtaining and disclosing national defense information. And that information concerns information that was leaked by the whistleblower Chelsea Manning.
When did you last speak to Julian?
I spoke to him yesterday, actually. He was in Stansted Airport and he was able to access a phone, and he called me over a video call, and I happened to be in Sydney Harbour. It was dark, but the harbour was all lit up, so he saw the Sydney Opera House through the camera.
Right.
And it was very nice.
You're hoping within a couple of days at most he'll be reunited, not just with you, but also with your sons, who, am I right in saying, are 7 and 5 now? Is that right?
Yes, they're 7 and 5, so the little one has only ever met his father inside Belmarsh Prison, so this will be the first time that we are all together outside of Belmarsh Prison, and they're very, very excited.
Stella, have you got thoughts about what comes next for you and for the family?
Well, we haven't really had much time to talk about the future beyond the next few hours and days. Julian's going to fly into Canberra tomorrow evening. That's Wednesday evening. Well, the first thing is that he's going to have to pay the Australian government back for the flight. It's $500,000, the chartered flight.
Right.
So that's going to be an immediate issue. But apart from that, you know, obviously we're just overjoyed that this is going to be a reality.
That was Stella Assange, wife of Julian Assange, speaking to NewsHour's Tim Franks. And this is NewsHour. This is Julian Marshall with NewsHour live from the BBC in London. Northern Ireland is one of the regions of the UK which will be voting in next week's parliamentary elections. There's always been a divide there between politicians who call themselves nationalist, republican, or unionist, wanting to maintain links with Britain. But elections there have recently seen a growth in support for politicians who define themselves as being outside those divisions. That trend emerged after the 2016 Brexit referendum, when the UK voted to leave the European Union. Northern Ireland is the only part of the UK to have a land border with another EU state, the Republic of Ireland, and that means Brexit has had a particularly major impact on politics. This report from our island correspondent, Chris Page.
Belsonic is one of those events which would have been hard to imagine during the conflict in Northern Ireland. Thousands are heading into the music festival in a park in Belfast city centre. The peace process has transformed this part of the UK, but people are aware there's still much political disharmony, and Brexit has been the soundtrack of the last 8 years.
There was a lot of misinformation that maybe led to a vote that people didn't want.
Northern Ireland really isn't capitalising on the position that we're in, being the link between the UK and the rest of Europe. I feel like that's been a completely wasted opportunity to bring in a lot more business, really help the economy.
A couple of miles away in Belfast Docks, I'm at a contentious Brexit pivot point. Northern Ireland businesses are in the unique position of having full access to the EU and British markets. But there's also been a trade border in the Irish Sea, checks on goods arriving here from Great Britain. That led the Democratic Unionist Party to veto the formation of a power-sharing devolved government for 2 years, until a new agreement 4 months ago.
There's much more to be achieved, because once we can repair the harm imposed by the arrangements that were delivered by the Conservative government, that doesn't mean that the overarching arrangements are suitable in the long term.
The DUP leader, Gavin Robinson, says more work's needed to eliminate trade barriers within the UK.
It's not a job done, but it's significant work progress, and we're going to build on that in the future.
8 years ago today, the result of the Brexit referendum was declared, a result that the DUP welcomed at the time. In retrospect, there are those who will say that Brexit has fundamentally damaged the union. What would you say?
The people were asked to choose. The people chose what they wished to see the future of this country being. It was delivered for Great Britain. It has not been delivered for Northern Ireland. And in that respect, democracy has been dishonoured.
Another pro-Brexit party, the Traditional Unionist Voice, is accusing the DUP of compromising too much. But unionists who opposed Brexit say they've been proved right. Doug Beattie is leader of the Ulster Unionist Party.
Brexit purists, they haven't got the Brexit they wanted. That's the problem. But the Brexit they wanted could never be delivered. The whole cohesion of the union has been damaged because of Brexit. But the Irish Sea border needs to go.
The Irish Sea border was put in place by Boris Johnson's UK government and the EU to avoid checkpoints on another frontier, the land border with the Republic of Ireland, where I'm standing now. Irish nationalists ultimately want to remove this red line on the map. The leader of the Social Democratic and Labour Party, Colm Eastwood, argues that most people in Northern Ireland want to rejoin the EU, and Irish unity is the only way to do it.
I don't think it's likely, given the political context, particularly in England, that any government will rejoin the European Union. I think it's very possible that we could do a whole lot more around the customs union and single market. But I genuinely believe that'll be very difficult to get back into the European Union as full members while we're still part of the UK.
For now is the time to plan for the future.
In recent years, Sinn Féin has become the first nationalist party to win the most seats in local councils and the devolved assembly. Chris Hazard is defending one of 7 Westminster seats. He says Brexit has caused too much blockage.
The assembly here now has been restored. People want to see us move forward. People want to see that strong leadership. People want to see the positive change in their communities.
Unionists say they want to work with the next Westminster government to try to get the remaining trade barriers between here and the rest of the UK removed. Are you prepared to work with them in that?
Yeah, we will work with anybody to at the end of the day to eradicate any barriers there may be. But as we said from the outset of Brexit, Brexit was always going to mean friction. Brexit was always going to mean barriers and new borders.
Brexit has arguably increased the focus on constitutional issues. But the party, which is neither unionist nor nationalist, has grown significantly.
Thanks everyone, it's great to see the room packed this morning.
The Alliance Party has doubled its support since the Brexit referendum. Its leader, Naomi Long, is running against the DUP leader in East Belfast, one of two unionist seats Alliance is hoping to take.
Alliance isn't advocating for a united Ireland or for the United Kingdom. What we're advocating for is the best possible outcome for Northern Ireland. I believe that closer alignment between the UK and the EU is best for Northern Ireland. I also believe it has benefits for the rest of Ireland and the rest of the UK. So it's a win-win.
Anybody got Golden Circle tickets?
Concert goers suggest historical identity politics doesn't have as strong a grip as in the past.
Issues of matter. Education's always very important in the economy, so we're getting to real politics here in Northern Ireland.
Care, the cancer treatment, all the different bits and pieces that people actually truly need rather than some of the other things that money's wasted on.
In Northern Ireland, perspectives are shifting, not least because of Brexit. This general election will show if the tune really has changed.
That report from our island correspondent Chris Page. And a brief recap on our top story. Kenya's president accused criminals of hijacking huge protests against tax rises, during which parliament buildings were set on fire and five people were shot dead by police. Dozens more have been injured. Well, 13 countries, including the United States, have now issued a joint statement expressing their concerns and urging restraints by all sides. At a press conference, US State Department spokesman Matthew Miller said Washington called for dialogue.
We condemn the violence reported during protests in Nairobi and around Kenya. We mourn the loss of life and injuries sustained and offer our condolences to the families who lost loved ones. We urge restraint to restore order and provide space for dialogue.
And in a statement just issued, the African Union has also expressed its deep concern over today's violence in Kenya. The African Union Commission Chair, Musa Faki Mohamed, urged calm and called on all parties to engage in constructive dialogue. The UN Secretary General, Antonio Guterres, has also said he is deeply concerned. That's it from this edition of NewsHour. From me, Julian Marshall, and the rest of the team in London, goodbye.